Please be seated. This panel of the court is now back in session to hear two more oral arguments. The third case on today's oral argument calendar is number A22-954, Powell Dominic Rezkowski versus Carolina Uribe Barrero. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for a rebuttal of 5 minutes. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please give me 1 minute. Okay, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I am Robert Due of the DeWitt Law Firm, and I'm appearing today for the appellant in this matter.
Could you please pronounce your client's last name?
It's hard, Your Honor. The first is it's kind of a J sound and an SH sound, so it's Rzeszkowski.
Thank you.
I'm going to call him the appellant.
All right.
In over 40 years of practice, I have never stood before this court representing a party who was awarded nothing in a dissolution decree. Appellant did not receive $1 of the $1,239,000 of assets owned as of the valuation date, 85% of which was acquired during the marriage with marital income. He didn't even receive the vehicle that he had been driving. The decree awarded no spousal maintenance to appellant, even though appellant had not held a full-time job for 14 years, even though he was chronically unemployed during the marriage, following respondent from New York to Georgia to Minnesota in furtherance of her career, and even though respondent earned $350,920 during the year just prior to trial and had had a six-figure income throughout the marriage. An appellant received nothing to defray his attorney's fees of $111,000, even though respondent had paid her attorney $98,000 prior to trial. And the district court found that appellant did not have the ability to pay his own fees, and that respondent did have the ability to pay appellant's fees. And that was obvious from the fact that there was $332,000 being held in a trust account. No fees were awarded, even though appellant prevailed on one of the two major trial issues, the issue of legal custody. It was a grossly inequitable outcome from what should be a court of equity, and the district court arrived at that outcome by misconstruing the law and abusing its discretion. Going back to the document that is in
conflict. Before you do that, Your opening comments suggest that you'd be making some kind of overarching argument, cumulative errors or something like that, but I didn't see that in the briefs. I see specific independent arguments that we should take piece by piece, some with one standard of review, others with a different potential standard of review. So are you now suggesting otherwise, or is it just a way to kind of prep your actual more specific arguments?
It was an introduction, and I do have more specific arguments, Your Honor. So the parties were married on October 1st, 2011. That was a Saturday. Appellant was presented with two documents to sign on the day before the Saturday wedding. Both documents were in Spanish. Appellant was not fluent in Spanish. No English version was given to him. No interpreter was supplied. He was not represented by an attorney. There's no objective evidence he was given a meaningful opportunity to consult with an attorney. He had been told that the documents were necessary to protect respondent from his premarital student loan debt. She admits that in her affidavits. The first document is this prenuptial agreement. I don't think the court needs to spend much time on it. It essentially provided that each party would get what they brought into the marriage. So she got her $190,922. He would get back his personal belongings valued at $219. That was using the exchange rate at the time. That document is of little consequence. The second document, the dissolution and liquidation document, purported to strip appellant of any right to ever claim any interest in any assets acquired during the marriage that were placed in respondent's name. Respondent made a concerted effort during the marriage to place all assets in her name alone.
If I could get to kind of the first part of the arguments here that I would want you to discuss, which is, what is it exactly that makes that second agreement unenforceable? Is it public policy? Is it something else? What is it exactly that you think made that unenforceable?
All of the above.
And the first issue. Why don't you give us the
first issue that we raised in the brief is that all of respondents' legal experts, we're not talking about our legal expert, all of respondents' legal experts who filed affidavits in support of her motion stressed the importance of that document, the dissolution and liquidation document, being signed after the wedding. Their opinions were consistent with the affidavit of appellant's Colombian legal expert, Jorge Diaz Cardenas, who expressed the opinion relying on the Colombian Civil Code, and I believe it's section 1774, that the document was a nullity because there was no marital estate to dissolve and liquidate before the wedding. Now, respondent initially made the false statement under oath that the document was signed after the wedding, but she backtracked after photographic evidence of both documents being signed contemporaneously before the wedding was presented. It was a miracle that those photos even existed. So that document was signed on September 30th, the day before the wedding. It was falsely notarized as of Monday, October 3rd. The notary actually misrepresented in the document that the parties appeared before her on October 3rd. Well, they didn't. They were touring a sugar plantation at that time. The district court's finding that the document does not, quote, purport that the parties signed the document on October 3rd, 2011, is clearly erroneous. It does so purport. The district court.
If I may stop you, and maybe I'm backing up to a more preliminary question. Do we treat this document as we would treat a contract, or as we would treat a court judgment?
I think as we would treat a contract.
But the district court reasoned otherwise, right?
Yes, and we disagree with that reasoning. I mean, I think that's all built on the fact that notaries have to have higher qualifications in Colombia than they do in Minnesota. We don't see that as a real distinction.
More than just qualifications. I mean, and now I'm probably going to paraphrase, but I think the district court said that notaries are essentially officers of the court with respect to uncontested matters, and so when they execute a document or otherwise approve it, it's akin to a court judgment.
We disagree with that.
Have I accurately restated the district court's rationale?
Yeah, I mean, notaries are, to some extent, there.
I just want to stop you. I just want to make sure, have I accurately restated the district court's reasoning? And if so, then tell me why that's wrong.
Well, I believe so, Your Honor. I mean, to some extent, notaries are officers of the court here. They're empowered by the state to accurately indicate when something was signed and under what circumstances it was signed.
But they're not equivalent to a judicial officer, a judge, magistrate judge, associate judge, anything like that.
I don't believe they're equivalent to a judicial officer in Colombia either. Colombia has a dedicated family court.
Well, but there is evidence that they are, right? I mean, if I understand the district court order correctly.
Well, okay, first of all, we disagree with that, but even if it's true, then if it's treated like a judgment, it still is contrary to Minnesota public policy, and I'll get into that argument.
Okay.
Okay. The district court made an analogy that the pre-signing of the document and the post-dated notarization were no different than the signing by a married couple of a stipulation later turned into a court order, and that doesn't hold water. The Colombian Civil Code expressly states that a marital estate can only be dissolved and liquidated by, and I don't know the Spanish word, but it's legally able spouses. And the parties here were not legally able spouses when they signed the document. So it's just in Minnesota. You can't sign a prenup after the wedding, and you can't sign a postnuptial agreement before the wedding. And that's what happened here. And I don't know, you know, obviously I'm going to argue on comedy and public policy, et cetera. I don't know that you need to reach that. All the experts agreed that had to be signed after the wedding, and it was signed before the wedding. So it can't really be denied that Minnesota has a public policy against enforcement of procedurally unsound and substantively unconscionable prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. I think that policy is clear from a long line of cases. You have Kramer, you have Kinney, you have McKee Johnson. It's clear from the statute. the district court does not say one word about that public policy. There was some mention of not letting a spouse become a public charge, nothing about the public policy in Minnesota that undergirds the law on prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. The dissolution and liquidation document was procedurally defective, we believe, under both Minnesota and Colombian law.
So you, the fact that you just, that part right there, under both Minnesota and Colombian law, I think we're kind of skipping past an important first step. Choice of law. Is there a choice of law provision in this agreement?
No.
So how then do we determine which law applies, Colombian law or Minnesota law?
Well, our position is under Colombian law, the document is invalid.
Right, but I'm not getting to that yet.
Yeah.
What your position is under either Colombian or Minnesota law is a different question than which law applies. The next question I would have once we figure out how to decide what law applies is what did the district court do? Did the district court apply Colombian, Minnesota, or both?
Well,
maybe we can skip to that second question, but I don't think we can get yet to reviewing what the district court did under Minnesota law unless we first conclude that, in fact, Minnesota law would apply.
Minnesota public policy applies. And in preparing for today...
Is that something that you have concluded based on Minnesota law, on contracts, or Colombian law? Because you still are asking the question, the choice of law question has to come first. Is there an analogous principle in contract law under Colombian law about public policy invalidating contracts? I don't know. So that's why I'm asking, the choice of law has to start. What law applies?
Based on my review of the law, whether it's a choice of law analysis or it's a comedy analysis, you always look to see whether the document in question violates the public policy of the forum state.
Okay, so you are saying that under Colombian law, there is a public policy basis to invalidate or to declare a contract unenforceable. What's what is the authority for that under Colombian law?
The civil code says that document had to be signed after the wedding, not before the wedding, therefore it's invalid.
Okay.
In preparing for today, I reread the Nickel v. Tanner case, which is one of our leading comedy cases, and there's a footnote 11, that says that there normally is a public policy exception. That didn't prevent comedy from being extended to the German judgment, because the German judgment was consistent with Minnesota's own policy on child support. So conversely, if it hadn't been consistent with Minnesota's policy, public policy on child support, that German judgment may not have been extended comedy and may not have been enforced. So I think that's the important consideration. Respondent's whole argument revolves around the notion that appellant was aware of the import of what he was signing, even if the document was in a language he didn't speak. That argument is essentially the dependent spouse knew exactly what he or she was signing. That argument generally has no traction. In practically every case where a marriage-related contract has been challenged, that argument is raised. That's not the litmus test. Mary McKee was a highly intelligent woman who knew exactly what she was signing. That didn't prevent the Minnesota Supreme Court from remanding for a substantive fairness review. Michelle Kramer knew exactly what she was signing, but that didn't prevent the...
But didn't the district court here say he didn't believe your client, that he didn't know what he was signing? So how do we now say, no, Judge, you're wrong in that determination?
Well, I got three things to say on credibility. First, the district court looked the other way when respondent made false statements under oath. It's clear that her statement that document was signed after the wedding was false. Second, the facts necessary to come to a just outcome in this case are not really in dispute. So credibility was never central to the decision. And I would make the point that the district court made its credibility determinations over appellant's objection on the basis of dry affidavits, and without the benefit of live testimony or even an actual hearing where oral argument could be presented, it's especially difficult to see how the district court could have read the well-considered and legally supported opinions of Jorge Diaz-Cardenas and come to the conclusion that he lacked credibility. I would invite the court to read those opinions and affidavits because they make a lot of sense.
Okay, so that also, I mean, it ties back to choice of law for me. The legal experts, if you call that testimony, which I'm not sure it is, it's essentially a way for the district court to learn Colombian law in order to apply Colombian law. And it's not like expert testimony in any other context. So it still comes down to, for me, what law did the district court apply?
Well, all I can say is the district court made a flat statement that it is inappropriate to apply Minnesota law as a test of the validity of the Colombian documents. So that was a legal conclusion that the court made. But I think what that skips over is under a choice of law analysis, a comity analysis, you have to make a determination of whether this document violates the public policy in the state of Minnesota. That wasn't done. And
well, I don't know that you would. If it was, let's put comity aside. Let's say we say that this is not a judgment, it's not an order from a court, so it doesn't get comity. It's a contract. And then if we said Colombian law applies to interpreting that contract, it wouldn't matter then if there's a violation of public policy under Minnesota law, because Minnesota law wouldn't apply, only Colombian law would apply, and I'm not sure I see a strong argument in your brief that it's against public policy in Colombia. I see the argument that it is against the civil code, and to that extent, to the extent that the civil code and public policy are one and the same, I can understand that. But I'm not sure that it's necessary to apply Minnesota law or to determine if the contract violates public policy in Minnesota. If we analyze this as a contract pursuant to Colombian law, we would only be looking at public policy if that is, in fact, a principle under contract interpretation in Colombian law.
I actually agree with that. And that's why we put our first issue in the brief was, if you look just at Colombian law, this document is invalid. Should have been signed after the wedding, according to the civil code. It was signed prior to the wedding. And the district court's analogy doesn't make any sense, really. If you have a married couple signing a stipulation, they've got the power, they've got the authority to do that, and then it's incorporated into a court order later on, then it's enforceable. These people did not have the power before the wedding to dissolve a marital estate that did not yet exist. So that is one way to resolve this case. If you rule against us on that issue, then I think you do have to look at Minnesota public policy. And I also think that the district court looked at Minnesota public policy. They looked at the Auer case, which is based on the Abbott case, that there's a public policy in Minnesota not to render a party a public charge. Well, I am representing a public charge. No job, no maintenance, no assets, and he was receiving SNAP assistance at the time of trial. So the district court did look at that public policy issue, and what the court said is, well, he's not going to be a public charge because he still has his spousal maintenance claim. Well, then we went to trial on spousal maintenance claim, no maintenance, and which was a violation, I believe, of the Carrick case, which is a published case of this court, and the court did not make the findings that were required for a spousal maintenance determination. So I'm out of time, and I'll sit down, come
Very
back
good.
Later.
Thank you, Mr. Dew. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, identify yourself and your client, and begin.
Thank you. Jack DeWalt, DEWALT, appearing on behalf of respondent, Ms. Carolina Uribe Barrero. Good morning, Chief Judge Siegel, Presiding Judge Johnson. Judge Bryant, it's nice to see you again. Again, I represent Ms. Carolina Uribe Barrero, who is respondent to this proceeding. Ms. Barrero asks this court to affirm the district court's order in all respects. The order was well thought out, supported by the record. Its conclusions were in accord with logic and the facts and law. And as it relates to spousal maintenance, child support, and attorney's fees, its conclusions were well within the district court's broad discretion to decide and should be upheld. At the court core of this case, Your Honor, and I think this gets to the questions raised to Mr. Dew and morning counsel,
is which law applies, if I can tag off the question raised by Judge Bryan. And I would say Minnesota law applies if that question was put to a respondent, and it applies through the doctrine of comity. The doctrine of comity simply is the commonly accepted principle that deference is going to be given to judicial acts, orders, and actions of foreign entity, whether that's a country in this case, whether it's a state or on occasion in Minnesota, tribe versus a state. And it will generally be followed, although it's a discretionary doctrine, provided it doesn't violate certain principles, which the district court outlines and which I can discuss. But most notably would be the principle of public policy. In this case, comity is clearly defined.
Mr. DeWalt, I mean, it seems that those are separate issues in the Medtronic and Bionics Corporation. I'm not sure that comity itself is how you decide the choice of law. I think there are a separate test that you would apply to determine which law applies. And comity is different to me than choice of law. Comity, as I understand it, is whether the different jurisdiction's order, how we treat that, right? That's a little bit different than whose law applies to a contract, for example.
No, I take the distinction, Your Honor, and I understand the question. Choice of law, I think, is a distinct matter in that situation. In this situation, I think, given the fact the law being applied, the contracts that are being reviewed, the questions being raised are all based on Colombian code, are based on Colombian agreements, are based on Colombian legal opinion. I guess the natural answer would be Colombian law should apply. I think that comity comes in, if I can tag on to that thought, then after that. And after that, I think, is if we were to do that and apply Colombian code, Colombian law in Minnesota, does that violate public policy here? That's what comity tells us. That's where the limits of recognition would normally extend to. We will generally not apply recognition to, for example, issues or decisions that would violate explicitly Minnesota's public policy. So I do think, Your Honor, if the question first is which choice of law, I think it's Colombian. The second question, I think, becomes at that point in time, how do we review that action or decision? And I think comity tells us we defer to Colombia until such time as that deference would implicate public policy questions within Minnesota. That would be my understanding of the analysis in that context, Your Honor.
Mr. DeWalt, I asked your opposing counsel if we treat the documents as contracts or as court judgments. What do you think?
I think that's a very interesting question because on one hand, Your Honor, they are contracts, as a prenuptial agreement here would be a contract and a postnuptial agreement would be a contract. I think at the point in time they're executed, though, and I think that gets to the question that was somewhat occurring earlier, signature versus execution. At the point that it's executed by a judicial officer, I think it becomes a judicial act. So if the, for example, prenuptial agreement was solely based on enforcement of signatures of the parties, in my layman opinion, Your Honor, would say I think it's more akin to a contract. But at the point in time we have a judicial officer in the form of a notary in Colombia executing that contract, I think it becomes a judicial act, just as an order from this court or any other court would become a judicial decision.
The second document, I'll call it a financial dissolution or separation. Is there anything like that under Minnesota law that's been considered or approved?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. We have within Minnesota law statutes allowing for legal separation, first of all, and then more explicitly postnuptial agreements.
Maybe I should refine my question. Is there anything in Minnesota law, statute or case law, that allows parties who are married to contract to a treatment that all property that we have is non-marital property, notwithstanding ordinarily applicable law?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, where would I find that?
Sure, certainly, Your Honor. That would be found in Minnesota Statute 519.11, Subdivision 1A. I'll say that again. 519.11, Subpart 1A, A as in Alex. That is Minnesota's postnuptial statute, which explicitly provides the same provisions, considerations, and relief as available to parties within a prenuptial arrangement, with an important distinction, I think two important distinctions, Your Honor. Here in Minnesota, we would say that for a postnuptial agreement to be valid, it has to have both parties represented, whereas in a prenuptial, we only need notice of representation.
Can I stop you just so, because time is short?
Understood.
In Minnesota, so when you say postnuptial agreement, I'm not sure what the contours are of that, but in Minnesota, may parties contract about property to be acquired in the future, not just what we presently have, but you know, can they agree that everything that we acquire in the future will be considered non-marital property of the person who owns the account?
Yes.
And that's within that same statute?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Any case law that you're aware of that has endorsed that?
I don't have case law on hand, and the reason I don't, Your Honor, is because the parameters of the postnuptial statute, 519.11, mirror the parameters of the prenuptial statute, the prenuptial provisions, and a prenuptial provision provides for explicitly what you're identifying. The entire body of case law around prenuptial agreements does that. Postnuptial agreement, to be very clear, Your Honor, is simply a prenuptial agreement after the fact of a marriage. And because it has occurred after the fact of the marriage, we have two procedural remedies to protect against duress of a married couple. One is there is a requirement for representation, which makes sense. And then two, there is a presumption a postnuptial agreement would not be enforced if a divorce begins within 2 years of its execution. That's different than the prenuptial agreement, and those procedural remedies built into the statute are designed to protect married parties who are in an unusual negotiating relationship. The parameters of the statutes, though, Your Honor, to be very clear, are identical relative to the relief available to parties.
Well, but they're quite different, aren't they? I mean, the Minnesota statute says it has to be, I'm not sure I'm using the right words, but kind of substantively fair and equitable, not only at the time it's signed, but at the time of enforcement. So while this may have been very equitable at the time it was signed, at the time it was enforced, I mean, there's a whole nother question there, because she's getting everything, he's getting nothing, right?
Sure. I would add that statement, not as a statement of fact and with a caveat to the last point, Your Honor, but I would say that the substantive fairness of enforcement that the court references, I think, applies to both prenuptial and postnuptial agreements, and I agree. It is at the time of execution plus enforcement. But again, now we're getting back to the question of application of Minnesota law, because if this court finds that Minnesota law, as defined in Minnesota, should apply to the review of every prenuptial and postnuptial contract that's executed in every other jurisdiction, I don't have much of an argument to present to the court today, because I think we have now completely disengaged ourselves from the doctrine of comity. And I would identify an issue that I think has never fully been explained in this file, which is if there was a dispute as to the procedural or legal propriety of the documents, particularly the third document executed in Columbia, why has appellant, who has the ability clearly to retain counsel in Columbia, not sought recourse in the jurisdiction that originated those documents? That clearly is, I think, a pertinent question that is unresolved. What I would say, though, again, and I hope I'm being clear here, is I do not believe under the doctrine of comity we have the extension of an analysis of substantive fairness at the point of execution and substantive fairness at the point of enforcement. When reviewing these documents specifically, we have a question of violation of public policy broadly. I think that's what I would argue, Your Honor, as it relates to review of the documents in question. And I think Judge Burns identified that very clearly in the district court's order, insofar as saying, A, I don't think this probably would comport in some ways with a review under Minnesota law, and explicitly states there's a good reason. It wasn't designed to. And to tag on to a footnote, I guess, his footnote also identifies, I think, sort of the inadequacy of that analysis, which would be, in what way would Columbia ever be able to craft a statute or code that could comply with every jurisdiction within the United States review of prenuptial and postnuptial agreements? Ergo, that is why we don't do that. We can't say to Columbia, you have to draft a code that comports with our review of a postnuptial agreement, and it has to comport with every other. So I think...
So it is, if yeah. I could ask a quick question. So,
of course, Your Honor.
Does the doctrine of comity, does that turn on whether we treat this as akin to a court judgment in Columbia versus just a contract?
Well, I don't necessarily think so, Your Honor. I think it is akin to a judicial act, which as set forth in Hilton v. Guyot, and I've never heard it pronounced, so I apologize if I mispronounce that. But that's the seminal case that outlines this. It refers to judicial acts, and I certainly believe, as does Judge Burns, that a notary executing a document after a marriage as the role of a judicial officer, as we would view it here in the United States, is akin to a judicial act. I would note, Your Honor, though, the issue of it being contract versus not contract was also addressed by Judge Burns in his decision, insofar as he identified that the general presumption is that contracts would be also deferred to as far as the jurisdiction of another state, and the cite to is Seizman's v. Christian Brothers Milk Company. That's in appellant's addendum 34. So I think Judge Burns has actually even identified that analysis and stated, insofar as we may say this is more of a contract as opposed to a judicial act, the doctrine or deference doctrine of comity still applies. My opinion, Your Honor, is once it has become executed by a notary in Columbia, I believe, in my opinion, it has become more akin to a judicial act, which is explicitly noted within Hilton v. Guyot as part of the premise for a doctrine of comity. I'm sure I have about a minute and a half. I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have.
I have some questions on other issues in appellant's brief. On the issue of spousal maintenance,
yes.
Isn't it necessary for the district court to determine the marital standard of living at the first step in subdivision one before making any final ruling denying spousal maintenance?
Well, I think that the court has to, the burden for a spousal maintenance request is on the requesting party. That's the initial issue, and I think that's an important piece to recall. I think often it feels as if the burden is on the responding party to prove it shouldn't, and in fact, that's not true. The burden is on Mr. Appellant to demonstrate need. In this situation, Your Honor, the problem that appellant has is his budget at the time of trial purported was just under $5,000 per month.
Okay, now, and where, I see that on page 24 of your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
Brief, proposed monthly budget of $4,900, but where, is that in the district court's order?
That would be, there's two orders before the court. That would be within the decree itself.
I didn't see it. But you're saying I didn't see it in the discussion of spousal maintenance or anywhere else either. But
it certainly is within the trial record, that was the position of appellants.
Well, but maybe that goes to my point. But I mean, doesn't the district court have an obligation when analyzing spousal maintenance to have sufficient findings on the financial information, and including standard? Don't we have to have a finding of reasonable monthly expenses that equates to the marital standard of living?
I think you have to have a question of a demonstration of need. And the question, I think what the district court's analysis was in subdivision one of 518.552 is at the time of trial, appellant's requested need was a budget just under $5,000. And that I am out of time. Is it all right?
Yeah, but please complete your
answer. Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. And so when appellant puts forward a claimed need of $5,000, the next question is, can he independently meet that need? And based on the opinion of the expert presented to appellant of his earning capacity that was adopted by Judge Burns of gross income, I think, of a relatively $8,500, and I'm rounding, he doesn't have a need. He's inadequately employed, and therefore that is the basis for his need. It is not a need based on independent income plus additional need for a budget above and beyond that. I hope I was clear with
you.
That, Your Honor.
I have one more question. It has to do with the attorney fees.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Ruling. There's a distinction, of course, between need-based fees and conduct-based fees. In this case, the district court found that the first factor for need-based fees was not satisfied because of the way that Mr. Rzeczkowski conducted himself during the case. I mean, didn't the district court essentially sort of use his conduct as a way of denying need-based fees, and is that proper?
I think that the statute explicitly, again, puts the burden on moving party to satisfy the three prongs of statute 518.
Right, and I'm not questioning the accuracy of that finding or statement by the district court. I'm just wondering if that's a legally valid reason for saying that the fees were not necessary for the good faith assertion of the party's rights in the proceedings and will not contribute, and so on.
I think the judge focused on the phrase in good faith, Your Honor, and I would identify that if a party has taken positions that are misrepresentative, have unnecessarily contributed to legal expenses due to positions that the district court finds to be largely without merit, I think district court appropriately so found that those fees that were being sought to be paid were not as part of a good faith assertion. They certainly were part of his assertion in general.
Can I have a follow-up now? And that is, let's say that is a legally valid reason. Doesn't the first factor ordinarily have kind of a little bit of a the decision-making might be sort of a sliding scale of how much fees are necessary. In other words, the fact that, I think that the second criteria, that whether so-and-so has the means, whether the other party does not have the means, those are more binary, yes, no. But I think the first factor is more, if the other two criteria are met, it seems to me the first factor ordinarily is a matter of how much. And so in this case, he incurred $111,000 in fees. The district court said zero. But, I can't imagine that his misconduct or lack of good faith was so pervasive that it affected all of the fees that he incurred. Wouldn't it have been appropriate for the district court to say, I'm going to reduce the amount of fees to account for the fact that in that one proceeding or with respect to that one issue, he conducted himself not in good faith?
I'd answer that in two parts, Your Honor. One is the burden is on the moving party to meet all three prongs, and I think Judge Burns did note that based on underemployment, he did have the ability to contribute to his own fees.
I don't think so. He said he did not have the means voluntarily or willfully or something like that, but he still said he did not have the means. But anyway, on the first issue.
Certainly, Your Honor.
The first factor.
Understood, Your Honor. I think the problem that the court is raising there is that it is doing appellant's job for appellant. Appellant's job in bringing a motion for need-based attorney's fees then would be to differentiate the fees that are incurred relative to claims. Appellant's argument here today, and to the district court, was that these are the amount of fees that appellant has incurred. It's $111,000, and we've incurred them for the entire time, all our legal fees. We then were successful on one of many claims that then show that there was basis for it, and therefore all of our legal fees, even the ones that I haven't segregated out relative to my erroneous, not put forward in good faith claims, should be granted. That is certainly not the basis for a motion practice at district court, and it certainly is not the basis for a need-based award of attorney's fees when reviewing the discretion of the district court. If appellant had provided Judge Burns a finite position that identified relative largely to custody, I have incurred X amount of fees, which I grant are not going to be nearly the bulk of that $111,000. There is not a way that's possible, in my opinion. I'd understand the point a little bit more practically. But certainly it can't be the burden of Judge Burns to try to differentiate these numbers without any kind of provision of analysis by appellant. Does that answer your question,
Yes, Your Honor? Thank you for that answer.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
If there are no further questions, it appears there are none. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Jew, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Go back to your first question, Judge Johnson. Can parties in Minnesota contract so that anything one party acquires and his or her name belongs to his or her, belongs to him or her at the time of the divorce? Yes, but those agreements are routinely struck down. And in fact, that's the McKee-Johnson case. Lance Johnson, the contract said anything Lance acquired in his name was his. Anything Mary McKee acquired in her name was hers. And the Supreme Court remanded that for a substantive fairness review. So that is the law in Minnesota. Whether it's a prenup or postnup, it has to be both procedurally fair and substantively fair. And I would say that the documents in this case are neither. I want to go back to what Respondent's Counsel told the District Court in his memorandum of May 10th, 2021. He argued that, quote, how these Colombian documents would be dealt with in Minnesota is irrelevant, and that appellant could be correct that the Colombian documents would not survive scrutiny under Minnesota law.
What are you quoting from? Is that from oral argument?
It's a memorandum that's in the record dated May 10th, 2021.
Okay.
And then Respondent's Counsel went on to say, appellant is also incorrect, and he wasn't using the term appellant at that time, but appellant is also incorrect when he asked this court to analyze the Colombian law that applies in this case. This court is not an expert in Colombian law, nor should it be. Arguments regarding the merits of either party's respective claims as they relate to the application of Colombian law should be raised in Colombia. These parties are U.S. citizens. They are Minnesota residents. As indicated in the expert opinion of appellant's expert, Colombia doesn't have jurisdiction. They're not residents of Colombia. We can't just send it back to Colombia. So the court has to either apply Colombia law or apply Minnesota law. If it applies Colombia law, I think it should be cognizant of the public policy in Minnesota. And back to Judge Bryan's questions, this document does not have a choice of law provision. It doesn't say that this document shall only be interpreted and enforced in the Republic of Colombia. Even if it had that choice of law provision, there's a lot of case law that says you still have to look to see if the contract is violative of the public policy in the forum state. So, let me just give a hypothetical. Client comes to me, very wealthy client, says, I want to get married, but I want to make sure that when I get divorced, I get everything that's in my name. And I say, well, that's probably not going to happen in Minnesota, but you could go to Colombia, and you could have a document drafted there and signed, and then when it's challenged in Minnesota, you could say, comedy, you know, Colombian law applies. So you can't even look at the procedural fairness of it, you can't look at the substantive fairness of it. I think that would be a terrible outcome. With respect to the spousal maintenance issue, the Carrick case is right on point. You cannot read the Carrick case and then conclude that the trial court made a good decision in this case. Carrick says you can't punish unemployed spouses for not becoming employed during the pendency of the case. And that's what the court did in this case. Now, he was submitting applications. He did go on two interviews,
Carrick,
et cetera.
Been limited by subsequent opinions in how to read it?
Well, not in my estimation.
Okay.
You know, I
all right. No, go ahead. You don't have much time left.
Yeah.
Do you agree that his reasonable monthly expenses were $4,900?
We tried to reduce that to a very reasonable amount, Your Honor. Her budget was over $14,000 a month, and she testified that that was consistent with the marital standard of living. They had been spending $21,000 a month prior to the separation.
But
the marital standard of living was much higher.
But your client agreed that his reasonable expenses were $4,900?
That was our claim. Approximately $5,000 a month is what we wanted.
I have another question. I think with respect to both spousal maintenance and child support, you're asking us to reverse and remand for new findings by the district court. Did you bring a motion for amended findings after trial? And if so, does that affect?
We did not bring a motion for amended findings. You know, my client's limited in terms of financial resources because he's not paying me. But number two, we thought that would be an exercise in futility based on what the judge had ruled. I think we are still able to make that claim now that the decision was made on inadequate findings. And in the brief, we've gone through the evidence that's in the record that relates to each one of the factors. There are a number of cases that reverse district courts for not making findings under 518.552 in support of its decision. And I don't think that really is dependent on whether the appellant brought a motion for amended findings or not.
On the issue of attorney fees, you heard my questions of Mr. DeWalt. Do you have any rebuttal to his
couple of things
on that point?
First of all, it's not necessary to be the prevailing party to get an award of need-based fees. I mean, there's a case on that. So you don't have to prevail. Second of all, I don't think there's any case where a trial court was affirmed by saying, I find you're not credible, you're not going to win, therefore you're not deserving of need-based fees. And I would say that the credibility was on a number of factors that are not really necessary for the court to reach a determination about the prenuptial and postnuptial agreements. I would hope that after listening to the arguments and reading the briefs, that you would see that appellant's challenge to the Colombian document was in good faith. And in fact, this very same trial judge issued a temporary order saying whether he wins or not, his challenge is in good faith. And therefore, I'm going to award $15,000 in temporary fees. That was the original order. Then after listening to all of the testimony, the trial judge was punitive and said, well, I find you're not credible, you're not going to get any fees. But first of all, the trial was very expensive. At least half the trial was on the issue of joint legal custody, and you can see that from all the findings that were made. And by the way, the judge didn't say that my client was not credible related to the custody issue. He prevailed on that issue. But he should have been awarded fees, and I think that issue should be remanded.
Well, and I apologize for this, but was there any evidence submitted on what of the fees had already been paid or not? No.
Nothing.
No evidence. It's just the total bill.
Yeah.
And then were there itemized,
yes,
you know, like so much for the hours spent on this?
Yes.
And okay.
There was an affidavit.
And I should have looked, and I didn't, and I apologize for that.
Well, let me just explain. The $15,000 that we were paid as a retainer, practically all of that went for costs. Okay? We had to hire a Colombian legal expert, et cetera, so didn't really get paid on that. And we asked for the total amount that had been accumulated, the $111,000, at the time of trial, and we didn't distinguish between what was related to custody and what was related
to
the other issues because we wanted it all. I mean, there was no reason to do that at that point.
And I think that, and there was the money there to pay it. It was in a trust account, so it's not like it was going to cause hardship.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.
Thank you.